Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Bring us up to date about what's going on for you.
I've done like 5 sample sessions this week. So I've been working on that. So I've been making.
How are those going?
They're getting better each time.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Any questions about them or any challenges that might be helpful for us to touch on here?
I had a question on, I was reading somewhere about like coaching and listening versus like consulting. Because so, for example, one of my clients was coming to talk about exercise. And so I teach her already on a weekly basis exercise. And she wanted to amp up her exercise. So it said in coaching, you shouldn't consult and give exact details on how to get there. I was confused. Instead, unless you are an expert at that?
Well, the model when someone is coming to you as a physical therapist or a physical, you're expert at that, that's a model of consultancy. You're not
okay.
Exactly coaching them. But they're coming to you as an expert, and you're guiding them in terms of what they should do.
They have issues, and
they ask you a question. You give them the answer. That's a consultant model. So are you looking at enhancing the work, intensifying the work that you do, or moving to a coaching model?
Well, I'm trying to do a coaching model. But she wanted specific things, but she wanted to lose 10 pounds by June 15th. So I was trying to help get her a plan, like how to get there. And I knew I could give her specific.
That's a trainer and a consultancy. When you say you wanted her to move to a coaching model, we began with the client. What you said what she wanted. So she wanted enhancing her workout routine and getting information from you.
Right.
So that's not asking for coaching.
Hi, Dr. Kruger. I'm here.
Welcome. How are you? I'll get to you in just a second.
So that's
not a coaching model. When you say you want to move her to a coaching model, what exactly do you mean?
I don't know. I was giving her a sample session, so I guess that's why I'm here to learn.
You are giving her a sample session for what? For coaching?
For coaching. And I said,
so
what's on your agenda?
Okay. Let's start from the beginning then. If you want to give her a sample session for coaching, you need to frame it in terms of professional coaching and indicate that the sample session would be to give both of you an idea of what it would be like to work together in coaching and then to invite her to think about a specific thing she'd like to focus on and something she'd like to take away. So
that's what I did. She met with me for 30 minutes. Her agenda was weight loss. She wanted to walk away with encouragement and motivation to have a better fitness plan.
Okay, so how can you convert that from giving her advice about exercise to a coaching model?
I said, what can you commit to next week to maybe add a couple of days in, like a walk, but I can do that. Or I said, maybe you can go to another exercise class, or
she said,
I can do that.
May I interrupt you now? You're still in the consultancy model, and you shot to the bottom line about telling her what to do. How can you engage her to co-create a story with you that will have her at the center of that and have her understanding more about her needs and ideals, what she wants to do, and to look at it in a coaching model?
I guess I should just maybe listen to her more and see what she, I don't know.
I'm sorry. Say that again. Bad connection. You think of what?
Maybe I need to just listen to her more and see what.
Well, you need to guide her into a coaching conversation. And to ask her what does she want to focus on during this session, and then what does she want to take away. And if she's talking about losing weight, you know, that's a negative focus, so that's not going to get her anywhere. She's not. So you,
okay.
you want to engage her to look at focusing on some aspects of wellness and what she wants to do. I mean, to look at it in turn, you need to reframe it for her where you can help her look at what perhaps what's worked before, what she wants to do, to develop her story. So the difference here in
okay.
one sentence is she's asking you in a consultancy model to tell her what she should do.
Exactly,
and
yeah, okay.
You want to convert this to helping her write a wellness story. So,
have her convert her.
A new story of wellness. Not a to-do yet, but a story of wellness. What is her objective? Where does she want to get to? What's her strategy? What's worked and not worked about that? For you to look at helping someone revise their story, you need to know what their story is. See, the consultant doesn't need to know because the consultant is going to tell you what to do. You don't need to know
okay.
their story, which is why consultancy doesn't work very well.
Right, so she went into, I know why I've gained weight, I got depressed last year, and I just stopped, and so now she's taking authorship that she's going to start exercising, and she sees it. So at that point, she's owning it, so do I just keep listening to her, or do I?
You're going to need to actively guide her step by step instead of the generalizations and the negative comments to create a new story about what she can do, you know, what her objectives are, what her short to shrink change to a week, a day, what is she going to do, and what is her objective.
Okay. So what can she do
to
change?
To actionable
okay.
steps, yeah. And to focus in a positive way about what she wants to achieve, what she wants to get to. The negative focus is about losing weight. That may help, but you know, we remember from quantum physics, we get what we focus on, not what we want. So we need to focus on framing things in a positive, adaptive way.
Okay.
So let's come back to her if it would be helpful. Paolo, go ahead. Bring us up to date about where you are.
Hi, Dr. Kruger. I'm sorry to interrupt you because I was so excited in getting into the seminar. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I cannot hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry that I interrupted your conversation. I was very excited that I got on time today. Okay. But I'm here and very excited to be with you and my colleagues. And I'm ready to do my presentation whenever
we get the time. We're ready to hear your roadmap case study in just a moment. Okay.
Okay.
Any progress note or anything you want to bring us up to date on about where you are, either in the training or in your practice?
Well, in my training and in my practice, developing my concentration, my focus, and starting to build plans for my new profession with NLS, and how will I work with people, and if it's going to be individual, if it's going to be with group or workshops. So I'm just giving some thoughts about this. Because I've never done like coaching with groups, or I never done a workshop with coaching. I always worked with individuals, and I'm very excited about this.
Do you have some of the fundamental aspects of a coaching business set up? Do you have like a business checking account, a business card, stationery, that sort of thing?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Not so far.
Maybe you need to do some mentor coaching for just a month or so about the basics of setting it up and the business framework jumpstarting your practice. Do you envision working mostly with individuals face-to-face or on the telephone, or groups face-to-face or on the telephone? What do you envision about your practice?
Well, actually, I'm already working with a woman from the East Partner of Brazil, and we do that through Skype calls.
Okay. Is that going to be the basis of most of your work, through Skype?
No. The basis is going to be face-to-face, mostly.
Okay. Remember, when you do telephone or Skype, you have an international venue. You can work with anybody in the world. You wouldn't be limited just to your area. Now, you may prefer to do face-to-face and do people just in your area, but that's a decision to look at how do you want to configure your practice.
Yeah, I don't discard this possibility of working via Skype with different parts of the world.
Okay.
And I'm comfortable with that.
Okay. That sounds great. Okay, we'll come back in just a minute. Emily, anything else, anything you want to talk about or focus on? Anything else?
Well, I had another question then about another client that I gave a session to was
in a question for a consultation question of the group so that we can focus on that with you, because I want to check in with Robin and then get to Paolo's presentation. What is your question?
I don't have a question. Never mind. Go ahead.
I'm not discouraging you. I'm just wanting to sharpen that because of time.
No, it's okay. I don't know how to address the question right now. I'll think about it and I'll get back to you.
Okay. Okay. Robin, what about you? Robin with us? Okay. We got another shot, Emily, if you want to do your question.
So I guess I think I'm getting stuck on giving more advice or consulting with a client than the encouragement, having a conversation. Because another client I had, she said she was needed help today. She's feeling anxiety about decluttering. And so I was trying to help her like reframe it, like what can you do today to go home to help you have less anxiety and maybe go through a box. Is that considered wrong? That's consulting too?
Well, it may be coaching, but you're giving her the answer. You're kind of ghostwriting her story. So I would say rather than advice or consultation or encouragement, that the primary purpose be to understand and facilitate the client's story. You know, what is she doing? What has she done? What is she doing that's working? What is her primary challenge? To really develop a more strategic way of proceeding and assume that the wisdom is in the client. You're going to be the catalyst for that, and that you're helping the client further their goals. So you want to get an idea of their goals in order to co-create strategies to get there and to shrink that to do steps each week. Not telling them what they should do, but eliciting it from them, getting them to create the story, because the purpose in mind is to be able to do this without you. And if you give them the answers, you're saying, in essence, I don't believe you can do this without me, and I believe my answers are better than the ones you could come up with. So it's really about listening to and helping to further the client's story. Now, it doesn't mean you want, at times, you know, give information, advice, and that sort of thing, but that's not the base, the fundamental of what you do. Whatever it takes to further the client's progress of their developing their own more effective story. So, yes, if you're inclined to give advice, I would listen more, I would guide the conversation to elicit more self-reflection from the client.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that from her. Like, we got to why she has the clutter. Like, she told me that, like, why it's there. And now she's ready to let go of the clutter. So that was,
okay.
I thought, a good conversation.
Uh-huh. Okay. And I wouldn't get too much into the why, because it doesn't matter why. It matters the strategy. In coaching, we focus on now and next.
No, present. Okay.
Making the most informed decision of choice in this moment. So, and think about what you did in writing your story. You focused on yourself. You elaborated that story. You walked through the steps. You were presenting a new story. There wasn't anybody who told you how to do that, and that's part of the experience of what you found valuable is the creation of that and the effectiveness of doing it. The introspection and the reflection that resulted in creating a new way of proceeding and the mastery that resulted from that.
So are you saying that each time you talk to a client, like, you want to have a roadmap for each conversation?
No.
No? Okay.
No, that was an overview comment about your presentation.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Paolo, you're ready to present your case study? Paolo, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Are you ready to do your presentation?
Yes, I am.
Go for it.
Okay. So I'm Paola Simoni, 63 years old, recognized authorship. My purpose to do the roadmap on money is to be aware of myself in this area. To be honest, this is the first time I write about it, or even make a profound reflection in such an important thing for us human beings. After so many years of dealing with money each day, it is an opportunity to develop my awareness about it, mainly to learn how to use it in a more respectful and responsible way. I've developed these values in myself because it's fundamental to balance the value of my income, my hours of work and dedication to my job and studies, and how I spend it without harming myself. I'm an English teacher, retired from the state education secretary. I am an expertise in accelerated learning and teaching in the USA, which made me one of the best English teachers of the area. This training taught me to combine both brain and hemispheres to and orchestrate brain waves to put the students in an alpha state in the classroom, using Baroque music, illustrations, stories, body language, and understanding the cycles of the brain waves, together with emotions, to optimize teaching and learning, reaching the long-term memory to teach and learn, not only in English, but everything that I want to teach and learn, whatever I need it. I taught English to my 4 kids and their friends. I've been retired for over 15 years. Whenever I meet my ex-students, they remember the good times we had together in classroom. They never forgot it. On my story. I come from a middle-class family where my parents, especially my mother, was quite careful with her budget. I don't remember a time that someone would knock at our door to collect debt. My parents always paid their bills in the due dates. Since my early adolescence, my father would ask me to go to the bank, stand on line to pay the bills. The family budget was pretty tight, but our parents gave us, the three kids, the best education they could. My father was Italian, who also had a good education. We never took vacation because the budget never included that part. I remember my mom every night checking and matching the family income with the family expenses to see if that would work. At that same time, my parents were very generous. Sometimes after church, my father used to take us for some ice cream, but once in a while, he would ask us to give the money for the ice cream to the poor people that were coming to Brasilia, where we live, looking for best conditions of life. We felt very touched by his attitude, and we please join him. This is something that my husband and I pass on to our kids. No matter how hard things can be, we always have something to give. Even if it's just a word or attitude of solidarity, not necessarily money. Although my mom was so careful about money, she had a weak spot, an emotional issue. My father came to Brazil to get away from the horrors of the Second World War. He used to drink to forget the pain of the terrible things that he had witnessed during that time. He was a very skillful person. He could speak 5 languages fluently and play the piano beautifully, but his psyche was damaged. For us, he was like a time bomb. We never knew when that next explosion would happen. Whenever it happened, he would break all the plates, cups, and saucers. He would pull everything out of his shelves. The next day, our house was just like a battlefield. My mom had to go out and buy everything again and again for years. He also threatened us with violence. My mom would get so emotionally imbalanced that she would go shopping for hours to compensate her frustration, anger, and sadness. Those hectares for sure would ruin the budget. When my father passed away, it was a relief for all of us. No one expressed that but me. One day she was mourning my father's death, and I asked her, I was 13 years old at that time, why are you crying? We finally have some peace at home. I didn't want to be rude, but that was the real situation. It took me some time to forgive my father. It happened when I learned the words of giving a rest with the Mohawk. May my father rest in peace. He did for us the best he could after facing the terrible war outside and inside him. And he had a great influence on me. No one can ever be the same after being in a world war. I grew up exposed to foreign languages and listening to my father telling us about all the countries he had been before coming to Brazil. Since that time, I used to tell myself that I would do just like my father. I would travel around the world and visit as many countries as I could. As part of my plan, at the age of 15, I asked my mom to enroll me in an English course. 2 years later, she agreed to let me participate in an exchange student program, and I went to Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes. What a great experience I had. When I got back, I got a job at USAID. And at the age of 18, I had a good salary, which allowed me to help my mom raise my two younger brothers. With the ability to speak English, many doors were opened for me, not only in Brazil, but also abroad. Just like my mom, I enjoy going shopping. The only way to deal with money is using it. Sometimes it brings happiness, and sometimes it brings concerns, losses, and it has its own movement of going and coming. It depends on our state of mind. The key is to learn how to regulate it, not the money, but the state of mind, which is the captain's head in the brain, connected with the emotional state that it happens in the heart. When I got married, I had finally met someone who had the same dream that I had, to travel around the world, something that my mother always discouraged me to go in such adventure by myself. That was a good thing to go on this adventure with a man that I felt in love, and my mom feeling more comfortable, given that she couldn't change my mind. We traveled for almost a year on our honeymoon. He was 22 years old and I was 20 years old. We hitchhiked the three Americas, Europe, and the Caribbean Sea, and finally, we came back to Brazil. One of the lessons I brought from the trip that I remember, it was that one day, my husband and I were walking in the Piccadilly Circus Street in London, and was so amazed at the beautiful things I was seeing, and I had the impulse to buy dresses and skirts. As my husband was watching me, he said, "What do you prefer? Fill your backpack with beautiful clothes or travel? We can only carry what fits in our backpacks. You have yours, I have mine. Whatever you put in your backpack, you are going to carry." My decision was immediate. I sure wanted to keep traveling, and I didn't want to carry heavy backpack. came to me a long life teaching. Almost 3 years after marriage, we decided to have kids. I only agreed to have with Beth after feeling confident that the man I chose to marry would stay with me and help me raise my kids, the kids we would have. In raising the kids, we decided to give them the best education possible. We had 5 kids. The first one died at 18 months old. He was born with a heart congenital malformation in the heart. For a long time, I mourned for that baby. Before he died, I already had a six-month girl, baby girl, who, in her innocence, helped me overcome that pain. Then I had one more girl and 2 boys. I set the clock storylines. We spent a lot of money with our kids. Our heritage for them would be education instead of patrimony. And because of these decisions, sometimes we lost control of our budget, mainly with the credit card and bank loans to pay them. Then we reduced the credit card to 2. I don't know how is that in other countries, but in Brazil, teachers don't have good salaries, just enough to keep us in the middle class. Because of this, we didn't have plans for savings. We don't regret for doing what we did concerning the kids' education. One has a PhD in public politics and sustainable development. The other girl is a very successful midwife. One of the boys is a physician, and the other owns, together with his father, a travel agency. And now we have 7 grandchildren. Decide what to change. My husband is a math teacher, so he's the one that most manages the finances. It's been more than 5 years that we have our credit cards under control. We have some savings that can be improved. I want to let go of emotional spending. I don't need to repeat the story I had with my kids, with my grandchildren. I love them. They are such a joy, but they have their parents who can provide what they need. Next changes. I want to produce more income. I will have a travel agency and are experienced travelers. People love to travel with us. Once or twice a year, we take groups of friends, relatives, and even families on trips to Cusco, Peru, where we live for a year, studying the Andean culture with focus on the Inca people, as well as trips to the beautiful Patagonia. I'm also very focused in working with NLS. And going through this training and leading the process, I can see the power of transformation in it. I'm sure I can help a lot of people. Also, new experiences, creating new money stories. For me, money is regulated by a state of mind. When my budget gets tight, I avoid going to shopping center. I go to something else. Money is whatever I want to see in it, depending on my state of mind. If I'm anxious, insecure, it's not a good time to enter the delicate territory of shopping. In the past, I spent endless nights with insomnia, worried about money. The next day, I was useless. That was like a nightmare. Now I want to observe closely my ideals and wants and stick to them. I want to have my savings for when I have an opportunity to do a training such as NLS or a deep study on aromatherapy, which is my passion in Provence. In occasions like this, I take a loan from my own savings with the commitment to pay it back. Meditation is something that helps me a lot, helps me regulate my state of mind. It's the time when I align my mind and my heart, check to see if there is any disturbance in my mind or in my heart, and find a way to solve it. One of the gifts I have in my life is to lay my head on my pillow and sleep peacefully all night long. That's it.
Thank you very much. That was very well done, very insightful and introspective to get to the point of really elaborating a very new story. Congratulations. Was this helpful to you, Paolo, in doing this exercise?
Very helpful, because I grew my awareness about myself and how I deal with money. And since I began this training with you, I've been changing fastly, you know, and I'm sharing this with my family. And I'm very happy to be here and doing this training. And I'm learning a lot.
Well,
especially dedicating myself.
Yeah, substantial work that you put into that summary. Thank you. Other comments or questions or thoughts about that from anyone? Emily, did you have any thoughts or questions or reflections?
No, I thought that was amazing. It was a lot of information to listen to. It was great.
Super. Well, thank you very much for that presentation and all the hard work that went into it. Well, I want to talk about a relationship story today, and especially if any of you are interested in doing work with couples, but especially to move that focus to the coach-client relationship, because I don't see much written about that, and I think that's where the real power lies. So I want to talk about both aspects, and most of the curriculum, the module, is about relationships of couples, so I'm not going to reiterate any of that. But first, let's look at what really matters. We know the best predictor of human happiness is human relationships, the quality, connection, and time that people spend with family and friends. We know that it's significantly more important than money and somewhat more important even than health. These findings are summarized in Dr. Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling on Happiness. Positive human contact, passion, joy, connection, and love create long-term happiness more than what happens even in our money story, our portfolio. Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman of Princeton surveyed over 1,000 American men and women to discern what correlated with happiness and contentment. Heading the list, nurturing relationships. In a number of studies encompassing people of many cultures, the most satisfying core feature of optimal human experience was nurturing relationships. So let's look at the influence of relationships. Neuroscience demonstrates that emotion can spread from brain to brain. Emotional attitudes, disposition, and states of mind are all contagious. This kind of contagion can occur without people even being aware of it. It occurs from brain to brain, from amygdala to amygdala specifically, and mirror neuron functioning is involved. Neuroscientists studied pairs of people, for example, using fMRI scans of their brains when they were interacting with each other. The brain state and emotion of one is mirrored by the other. And whenever one disconnects or stops listening, that harmony and synchrony of the two brain waves immediately stops. And here's a related finding. This is a study by Dr. Nicholas Christakis. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard. He studied social networks following 12,067 people for 32 years. And he demonstrated that we are all embedded in vast social networks of friends, families, coworkers, and more, and looked at the impact of that. Here are just a couple of the things that he found. He found that clusters of friends show a kind of contamination, and that's in a positive way, in the induction of issues including unhappiness, spending, drinking, smoking, exercise, healthy diets. He shows how an individual's location in the network impacts behaviors in subtle ways. For example, in one of his extensive studies, the contagion effect is there in everyday life. For example, at restaurants, on average, we eat alone the least amount, with one other person, 35% more. In a party of four, 75% more. In a party of seven or more, 96% more. Now, what may be causing this contagion. Well, one is mirror neurons. Emotional attitudes, dispositions, states of mind are contagious without people even being aware of it. When people resonate with one another, they impact one another. Another is induction. If I gain weight, you gain weight. It changes ideas about what's acceptable, and a norm or behavior can spread from one person to another. And another is confounding. We share common exposure to places like restaurants or gyms, blend with others, and intermingle influences ranging in everything from nutrition and wellness to wealth accumulation. Now, here's another example of that. A study in San Diego had this setup. Researchers hung four flyers on doorknobs. One flyer told homeowners they should conserve energy because it helped the environment. Another, saving energy was socially responsible. Another said it saved money. And the fourth said the majority of neighbors in the community were doing it. The researchers found that the houses with the fourth flyer, the majority of the neighbors in the community were doing it, showed the most change, in fact, more than the other three combined. Simply urging people or telling them it's a good idea to recycle or conserve energy was actually the least effective. So that's a consideration in looking at this. Now, one thing to consider here that I want to revisit the concept of empathy as a listening perspective. Empathy, recall, is listening from inside the experience of another. It's our ability to place one foot in the shoe of another to resonate with someone else's experience, including how that person thinks, feels, constructs meaning, and communicates, to know as much as possible, their subjective reality, and to not get lost there, to keep one foot in our shoe. So this has an application, as in the situation that Emily presented, that we want to know what the primary challenge of the client may be in order to go from where the client is to someplace new. If you present a service or a product to someone, you need to know and resonate with what their primary challenges are, because that's the way to begin with your communication, by resonating with their challenge, their issues, or their pain, so that you begin by creating a common ground to construct or co-construct a way to look at things in a different way. Now, I want to look a little bit here, as I mentioned, at the coach-client relationship. I want to focus on this because there are aspects I just don't see anywhere else, and I believe it's important to you getting, keeping, and benefiting clients. I think it can make a major difference in your effectiveness. Now, we're usually taught as coaches to address the content, the agendas, intentions, actions, goals, and we've already discussed benefits, behaviors, performance. I want to focus for just a bit on the process. It's what happens while you're talking about something else. It's not simple or linear, but it's what is communicated in the exchange. It's how the client shows us exactly what it's like to be them. It's, for example, an attachment pattern that they may not know how to describe, but they live out with us. It's a behavior pattern that they enact with us without necessarily being conscious or objective about it. So our clients will tell us several things: what's most important, what their needs are, what their primary struggles are, what's beneficial, and what's not. Now, for this, we have to listen really carefully and listen to various forms of communication. In fact, the previously uncoachable client may be one who's just been unheard at the level of need expressed, or has subtly gotten the coach to respond in a way that reiterates an old pattern. For example, the coach gets frustrated in the same way that others have in engaging the client. New addition, but the old story. Or a client may recreate the same process as with others, In other words, presents confusion about how to proceed, just wanting advice, being told what to do, ambivalence with reluctance to move ahead. So the coach finally ends the uncertainty and suggests an action. The result, the old story is recreated, and the client's just as stuck as ever. These clients may better be understood at a different model, in a different level that offers a more optimum responsiveness. Now, so here's another example of what I mean by process. Clients know what they need, though not perhaps in conscious or logical or daytime language. They will try in every way possible to let us know what it's like to be them, to activate the aspects of their experience that need to be addressed in coaching, in a here and now model. And we have to read this story accurately to co-create or guide the creation of a new one. Now, this, I believe, is what Carl Jung referred to when he talked about the strong influence of the unlived life of the parent. So, we gather information, not taking it personally, and that's a challenge sometimes, some of these kinds of unspoken subtext from clients. And these are in your outline. Self-statements, although stated directly at times as if it were about you, the mentor coach. And it's hard to recognize them or remember that they're self-statements when the finger's pointed at you. A wish or a fear. You'll have the answers, or you don't have any answers either. A disappointed recognition. You just don't seem to know either, do you? Hope. You're the greatest, with the unspoken subtext, so I too can become great. Feelings. To use this information now and move toward a goal, not to go backward to understand it as if still in an old story. Or the second no that always means yes, or once would have been sufficient. So as mentor coaches, we listen carefully, simply, literally. Deepest truths are clothed in the simplest of garments. We believe what's said the first time before other words get in the way. And we may hear somatic language, literally and symbolically, the rumbling stomach that whispers swallowed pain, hypertension, a pain in the neck. The role of storyteller and listener unfolds on the shared lap of the mentoring relationship. Part of the experience of story making is the feel, the safety, the trust, the ambiance of connectedness, the resonance of voice as well as words with a knowing receiver, confidential, collaborative. And as Lily Tomlin said, he listened with an intensity most people have only while talking. The message contains the message. In other words, the message is a full and valid communication to be understood in its own right before the venue or the focus is changed. That is, the immediate communication and experience of a client yields initial understanding before looking at what the client is trying not to say or may really mean or where they may really want to go or something deeper. For example, often a client will say as a first sentence in a session what she needs to do in that session. Now, I've had this opportunity to see this play out in hundreds of training sessions as mentor coach and dean of curriculum and coach training life. Two examples. Well, I know I should just say no and stay on track, but here's the struggle I have with time management. Now, that's a billboard for an agenda, not a drop-off comment, and that's exactly what the client needs to do is to develop boundaries and say no to certain things. Another example. I work with an executive who began with, he was the COO of a law firm. He said, I know I'm going to have to dissolve this partnership, but here's the situation. Toward the end of the session, he said, you know, this is great. You've helped me see exactly what I need to do and strategize to end the partnership. I played back for him his own acknowledgement in the beginning, his first sentence of that session. and summarized the process of insights he had through the session point by point so that he could make it really his own and claim it. My purpose was to help him internalize the process, the model, so that ultimately he wouldn't need me to do it. Now, in a way, it's not enough to construct a new experience. We need to help a client create and formulate a new model in which to understand and incorporate those new experiences. This is the P of the roadmap, to transform identity as well as behavior. This new model, this container of present and template for the future, is hope personified. It's a collaborative immersion of mentor, coach, and client. The past and present are never more distinguishable than at the very moment they're juxtaposed. This is the new story, now and next, present and future. Now, as a sort of footnote, I'd like to borrow a concept from psychoanalysis and talk about it briefly to show the usefulness in mentor coaching. Transference is the repetitive ways of organizing current experiences based on past experience. Transference is the organizing process of how we perceive, attach meaning to people and to experiences. It simply means we use software developed at some point in the past to read a current experience. It's a combined neural lexicon of repetition and self-statement. Now, most of the time, this is helpful because it allows us to use vast experience and to use a shorthand for that in order to quickly read and respond to situations. But at times, it can be limiting because past perceptions and past solutions have become outdated. So the model that you used was one that was tailored for an earlier circumstance and may no longer simply apply. So transference is basically a repetition, a whole playground of repetitions of past experiences with important people. In other words, using software devised in the past to read a current situation, but the software has become outdated. Now, in mentor coaching, we focus on the new story. We don't bother the old story until it bothers us, but inevitably in coaching, the old story will get activated. It will come alive alongside the new story being created. So we don't engage it until it becomes evident. And if necessary, we address the belief or the assumption of the old story just enough to cleave it from the present, to reduce or actually to refocus on the new evolving co-created story. Now, two kinds of memories get activated as processed: explicit, or in other words, factual memory, and implicit, which is procedural memory, like a relationship pattern. The mentor-coaching relationship will activate the behavior patterns and the attachment patterns of the client. What this does is offer an opportunity to understand and retranscript patterns of feeling, thought, self-regulation, and behavior. We continually help the client distinguish the old story from the new. Here are a couple of quotes that emphasize that. The mind is author of internal assumptions, producer of the individual life drama, and casting director of significant others. And the other quote, models of relationships with others get established very early in life and become the software through which subsequent relationships are perceived, organized, and processed. At least until adulthood, the software is not viewed as one way of looking at things, but as the reality, as the way things are. A fish cannot describe water. It can't get outside the system in order to do so. Now, both of these quotes were from my last professional book as a psychoanalyst, Integrating Body Self and Psychological Self. And now, this is the basis of what I mean when I say don't take it personally, and that the client is always showing us exactly what it's like to be him or her. So it takes two real people for this co-created immersion to develop. The mentor coach must come to know how the client feels, senses, perceives, and processes experiences moment by moment and frame by frame. The meaning attached from the past story needs to be constantly examined in terms of its usefulness in the new story. This also means that the client allows himself or herself to use the mentor coach in a way to simultaneously be inside the old and the new stories. Now, I want to talk about mindset, but I'm going to go on mute for just about 15 seconds. Hold on for just a moment. Okay, let's talk about mindset now. We each have a running account of what is happening to us, what it means, and what we should do. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. And we've talked about this once before. What we know now from neuroscience is that our brains operate like a Google map. We see a situation, and our brains boot up a particular mindset, a particular map to process that information. So what we want to do is be sure we're using the right map. Mindsets frame an ongoing account of how we interpret, how we process, and what we do. And mindsets are powerful beliefs of the stories about ourselves. So this is one of the things that we're listening for in our clients to be sure they're using the right mindset, one that is applicable and relevant for their situation. Here's an example of a broad perspective of mindset for us to talk about for just a moment, fixed versus growth mindsets. This is a simplistic example of two different mindsets, growth versus fixed. The view you adopt, though, can significantly affect the way you live your life. So growth mindset, I want to just highlight here, this is something we coach toward, something we want to foster or develop in our clients. A growth mindset is based on a belief in change. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. You become open to accurate information about talents and abilities. You use it to adjust and to grow. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have, as he terms, a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. This is the essence of self-reflection, and this is what we want to develop in our clients, the process of self-reflection, so that someone can develop a greater empathy with themselves. The growth mindset of learning is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolved throughout life. The fundamental assumption is that everyone can change and grow through experience and application. You can even change how intelligent you are. Now, contrast that with a fixed mindset. And in my view, anytime there is any evidence of that from a client, that's a time to intervene or to focus together. Those with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal is to prove oneself, whether that's in the classroom, in a career, in a relationship. A fixed mindset requires proving yourself again and again. Each situation calls for a confirmation of intelligence, personality, or character. The repeated internal questions, will I succeed or fail? Will I look smart or dumb? Will I be rejected or accepted? Will I be a loser or winner? Yet, with a fixed mindset, no amount of confirmation can dislodge the hypothesis of mediocrity or the need for proof. A fixed mindset makes you preoccupied with how you're going to be judged versus a growth mindset focusing on improvement. So here are some of the characteristics of a fixed mindset. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem include assigning blame or making excuses. Beliefs are often not conscious, but yet if you pay attention to them, you begin to hear them, and then you can change them. We can nudge someone toward a growth mindset. What can you learn from this? How can you improve? Here's an illustration of the impact of belief and mindset. 105 Israeli soldiers participated in a 15-week commander training program. In this study, neither the trainers nor the trainees had any idea the test was being conducted. The training officers were informed outside the participants' awareness that each soldier had been classified into one of three categories of command potential. The training officers were required to know each of the soldiers' personal data as well as their command potential category. At the end of 15 weeks, the new soldiers took a written test to measure their new knowledge of the variable that they had learned in training. So here are the findings. The soldiers who the training officers thought had high command potential scored significantly better on the test. They had an average score of 80 compared to the middle category of regular counterparts of 65. The training officers' belief in the participants made a significant difference in their performance. They lived into the belief of them. Another example. A group of 51 women were selected to have a short conversation with a randomly selected man. Now, each man, before calling the woman, had received a biographical information and a snapshot. Now, the bios were accurate, but the pictures were not. Half were a very attractive women, the others not so attractive, quite ordinary. After the conversation, each man filled out a questionnaire to rate his expectations about the women. As expected, the men who saw pictures of pretty women expected the interactions to be of someone who's more sociable, poised, humorous, and socially adept. The other group of men expected the women to be maybe a little bit serious, awkward, socially inept. Now, here's the intriguing part. Then an independent jury of different people heard only the voices of the women that came from that conversation and were asked to rate them according to just that conversation. This independent jury of men and women rated the women the same as the men attributed. So the women unconsciously picked up on the beautiful opinion and the men responded accordingly. They lived into the belief of them. And another very brief example. The same process occurred in a Yale study of senior citizens. In a longitudinal study, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over a 3-year period. That was statistically significant. For example, there was a significant drop in the hearing test score equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in a 3-year period. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, even cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years. Just the mindset, and the mindset that boots up the software program of expectations and beliefs and how you read things. They lived into the belief of them, or died into it. Now, let's look briefly at instinct and prejudice. We have to distinguish our blink, our instinctive thin slicing of data to quickly come to a conclusion, at times from a buried prejudice. Deep within our unconscious, we have connections that can only be called biases, even when we consciously abhor them. We each hold a collection of stereotypical beliefs and attitudes about social groups that exist often without our permission or our awareness. These beliefs color perceptions, expectations, and even decisions, and can find their way into the process of the mentor-coach-client relationship. The assorted stereotypical notions about social groups can range from male-female, black-white, elderly-young, gay-straight, fat-thin, just to name a few. Regardless of our conscious desire to avoid the bias of stereotypy, these attitudes shape the contours of our daily decisions. So we need to know if these stereotypes are buried deep in our psyches without our permission or even our awareness. The meaning that we attach to what we perceive determines its emotional impact. So by changing the meaning, we can change the emotional impact. With awareness, we can even alter our response to the emotional contagion from someone else. Of all the variables studied to address bias and overcome prejudice, the strongest correlation with overcoming a prejudice is a powerful emotional bond. The register of social ostracism and rejection occurs in the same node of the brain that registers pain. Now, there are many learning laboratories for positive connection, including friends, colleagues, mentors. Research suggests, but mostly our experience informs, that we can develop awareness, reshape implicit attitudes and beliefs, and adjust biases. That is, develop new life and relationship stories. The mentor, coach, and client become co-authors of that new story and create a current meaning that allows a distinctness of the old versus new in an evolving new story. Now, this is what I consider the most important part of what we talk about today. We are always teaching others how to respond to us. Your client is always teaching you what it's like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that you can teach it back to her out loud. You have to be open to that learning and not let your theories or your agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client can develop an authentic story. What our clients want from us as mentor coaches, I believe, is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we can give it back to its creator as self-statement. Full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from a client's view. To see at times a thought, a feeling, or a behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. I got that from X-Files, but I'm sticking to it. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result. To see the hope camouflaged at times in the frustrating process. And to hope that we will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in that process. The architecture of trust silently forms while we talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experiences, and pushes creativity to full flight. We also help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Julia Cameron, I believe, said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I'm astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. And invention has been sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in the old story, repeating the same storylines. We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary is believing in the client. The corollary to believing in the client is that we as the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe that we will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates their growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present model and the present moment may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. Probably the most powerful and change-making experience the client has ever had. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line is, does it work? Mentor coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, and untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must bring an issue to the table and risk the experience of doing that. Risk is inherent. And further that risk by looking at it. The exchange has to be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach has to be fully present, fully himself or herself. Hemingway captured this principle, captured it succinctly, I said, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. An ideal co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to let the client know and see what they already know and just a little bit more. This little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, even to celebrate. So just a quick word about coaching with couples. Here are some additional thoughts in addition to the curriculum about working with couples that considerations I believe are important in terms of the practical coaching aspect. When you work with a couple in couple coaching, the couple, the relationship is the client. It's not two individuals. It's the relationship. There is no confidentiality with one partner regarding the other. There is absolute confidentiality for your client, the couple, the relationship. So build a holding environment, a container for the work that's safe and respectful, that houses listening and builds trust. This container requires ground rules and boundaries with active involvement of the coach to establish them. Most important is to establish a process, a format for that respect, listening, waiting for the other to finish, checking in, understanding. We do not advocate for either person, but for the couple. We listen for strengths to build on, to use for repair. We counter the number one defense couples use of blaming each other by holding the couple accountable and responsible to be respectful in the relationship. Mentoring couples includes the fundamental components of individual coaching, though they're focused on the couple as the unit. The relationship itself is the client. So the simple things we do, establish the coaching alliance, perhaps create a vision, develop an action plan, implement the plan. The mentor must always appreciate the developmental evolution of a relationship, the stages of development of the relationship, and how they parallel the individual developmental stages of growth. So for a couple, both external core issues and internal core issues that affect them are important. And external things may be parents, family members, children, career, money, religion, neighborhood. Internal core issues include things like ideals for each individual, individual styles, temperament, health status, personal habits, money psychology, individual needs and differences. For external and internal issues, remember, the issue is the relationship. And just a simple example here about something we may need to appreciate in coaching. If one partner's brain is wired to have, and we've touched on this before and I just want to reiterate it, if one partner's brain is wired that money equals security, then for that person, the focus would be on saving, developing a nest egg, having the security in the language and the not just the metaphor, but literally of money. If for the other partner, money equals freedom, then the ability to spend, to enjoy the money, to really use it in a here and now way will be important. So with two different kinds of mind maps of the meaning of money, the relationship issue has to develop a common ground of compromise and planning together about how to approach two very different meanings of money and very different expressions of money and a money story. So, what kind of thoughts or questions do you have? Anything about anything I've covered or talked about that would be helpful to elaborate or discuss in any way? Does this make any sense as an extension of the material in Module 8? Clarifications or questions?
I was very impressed that when doing the mentor coaching with couples, the relationship is the client, right?
Yes.
So we don't work personally with each one. We work with the relationship itself, right?
Right. In other words, we wouldn't meet individually with one or agree with one if one called up, Sal, I want to tell you something, but you can't mention this in the session. I would not listen to that. I would emphasize from the beginning as a framework of the session, as you began with them, that everything that we talk about is absolutely confidential, and everything that happens will happen together with all three of us, not any side conversation.
Yes, and
is that what you were highlighting?
Yeah, and how each one can bring to the table in order to save the relationship, right?
Exactly. So what we may need to know and look at are an appreciation of individual styles and work styles. There's a paper under my articles tab on my website called Toward Brain Hardware Optimization that has some to do with different work and relationship styles, different performance styles, and some different kinds of things that may be helpful in better empathically understanding a client, and especially may be useful in working with a couple. For example, in working with a couple, it's the only time I use a different instrument than one of the things that may be in your that are in your curriculum and workbook. Sometimes I find it helpful to use the Myers-Briggs, and it's a just kind of a quick profile of personality style, and the two books that are most helpful here is Please Understand Me, Roman numeral 2. It's a very small book. It has the Myers-Briggs test in the back, and you can also do the Myers-Briggs test online to give you an idea of a personality style. and you can do it free. It's at www.keirsey.com. And understanding a personality style can be helpful in bringing together two people who have different styles and different interpretations of things in order to co-create, to build a common ground for them to understand each other, because sometimes the derailments are about the different styles. There are a couple of examples in that paper that you might find useful to look at. And please understand me, Roman numeral 2. I've asked each member of the relation, each couple, each person to buy a copy of that book and take that test in the back and tell me the four letters that that is their style. And then I use a book myself. I don't recommend this to the client, but I use a book called Type Talk at Work, TypeTalk at Work. And there's an elaboration in the book of each of the 16 different styles. When you do the test, there are four different measures and four different letters. So there are 16 variations. And each variation is consistent from, you know, childhood throughout life. And each of the 16 configurations really tell you a good deal about what kind of personality and style and ways people relate. You might take the test just to see if it tells you anything about yourself and if you think it might be useful in working with a client. So we're going to have to stop for a couple minutes over. Thank you so much, and we'll pick up. We are next week at week 11, so we have two more seminars and weeks left. And remember from the schedule, next week I'm going to be running in the Boston Marathon with my daughter, so we will not meet next week. We'll have our next session 2 weeks from now. And
okay. I'm going to miss that session. I think that I'm going to miss the one after that one. I'm going to be in Mexico teaching a retreat, so I'll miss you on that one.
2 weeks from now?
Yeah. So there's no class this Monday, you said, correct?
No class next week. And then our next to last class is 2 weeks from now, and our last class is 3 weeks.
Okay. So can I listen online? So
oh, yeah.
Makeup?
It'll be posted within 24 hours.
Okay.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great rest of the week. Bye now.
You too. Bye-bye.